the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II...
A state of war.
...to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. My guest is retired Colonel Carol Glines, a noted military historian who has authored 34 books, including three about the April 1942 bombing raid against Japan carried out by the Doolittle Raiders. That mission came at a time when U.S. morale badly needed a boost. The nation was still reeling from Pearl Harbor, and the Japanese were consolidating and expanding their empire in almost an unchecked way. Glines was a cadet pilot in training in Texas when it all began.
In those days, we didn't have the radio. In fact, as cadets, we weren't allowed to have radios, for example. We never saw a newspaper. And I remember on December the 7th, which was a Sunday, one of the kids had a radio in his car. We were advanced flying training. So he said, did you hear the Japs have bombed Pearl Harbor? Well, we hadn't heard of it at all. We didn't know where Pearl Harbor was either. Nobody seemed to know. The next day was Monday, and I went to the flying line with my compatriots there, and there was a note on the board, formation today, follow me, there's a war on. And that was the first clue we had that there was any kind of a real battle in Hawaii. So we went on to... follow our leader, we have a formation flight, and went down to Matagorda, and our guns were loaded. When we got in the airplane, we hadn't prepared for gunnery practice. But when the guns loaded, our instructor just said, follow me. So we followed him, and we did our patterns around shooting gunnery at Matagorda Island. But then instead of coming back to the base at Victoria, Texas, he went out over the water. Of course, we had to follow him. And... after a while, I thought he's in the mist. There was the visibility was not very good. I thought he's lost his way. He must think we're supposed to go. We're going back to the base. Anyhow, he turned around eventually, and the whole formation of us all got back home. And on the ground, one of the guys, my fellow students, asked him, "Sir, why did we go out over the water? We'd never been out over the water like that before, out of sight of land." And he said, we were supposed to look for submarines. And that was as close to our feeling that there was something going on in the world. So that we really didn't know, those of us in our status as cadets, then getting commissioned on January 2nd, what was going on. And I just don't remember seeing newspapers in those days. When I was made an instructor, I had... students every day, flying 7 days a week in the first part of 42. But of course, since then, as a writer, I now realize how shocked the country was in 1942, in the spring of 42, and how much the Japanese had done in the Pacific, which I had not known before I started studying World War II. And the Japanese had taken the... Wake Island, Guam, and we're in the Philippines. And by the spring of 42, they were about to conquer the Philippines. Well, then, of course, the raid came along, the Doolittle Raid of April 18th, 1942. And after it was over, the raid was completed, we got the headlines in this country that American bombers had bombed Japan, which was a surprise to most of us who were flying every day, knowing there was now a war on, but not knowing the extent of it, especially in the Pacific. So those of us that were flying every day as an instructor, I think we were pretty oblivious as to really the details at the time. Mm-hmm. But of course, as a writer now, I know what happened on April the 18th. And all the preliminaries ahead of time. And General Doolittle leading that famous mission. And the aftermath of the mission. And that has been my interest for a long time. Although I've written 36 books, the three books I've written on the raid are the most comprehensive work I've ever done as far as writing is concerned.
Well, the impact was enormous on public opinion at a time when a boost in public morale was very, very badly needed.
That's right.
And as you've studied that impact over the years and researching your books on this particular project, how do you measure it now?
Well, I can understand what President Roosevelt must have been going through. He called his admirals, top admirals and generals together and said, we've got to retaliate, we've got to fight back, we've got to prove that we can fight back. And I think he envisioned bombers taking off from China and bombing Japan because the distance there is not very great. But of course we didn't have the capability in bombers to do that at that time from China. So the story, of course, is that a Navy submariner named Captain Lowe wondered if it could be done. He was on the staff of Admiral King, Chief of Naval Operations, and he broached the question to the boss, He wondered if Army bombers might be able to take off from a carrier and get the carriers close to Japan. And that way, then the president's wishes could be carried out. Well, we all know what happened. Of course, that General Doolittle, or Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Doolittle at the time, was given the task of determining if there was an airplane that could fly off of a carrier, Army Air Force bomber, to make such an attack. And we know, too, that he was a graduate of MIT with a doctorate. He was a doctor of science, which few people knew about.
Mm-hmm.
He's known publicly as a daredevil racing pilot who had won races and did tremendous acrobatics at low altitudes over air shows, and that was his public image.
Well, he was something of a legend already in that respect, wasn't
yes,
he?
Yes, he was. He was, and but his legend was, of course. I mean, the public image of him, and among many of the generals of his time, was that he was a reckless flyboy.
Hot dog.
Mm-hmm. And that, of course, was not so. I called him for the master of the calculated risk, and he was. He always practiced at altitude before he did anything at low altitude that we would think as pilots would be almost impossible to do.
So we'll come back to talk more about his leadership in a minute, but on the mission itself, you mentioned his doctorate in engineering from MIT, it strikes me that this was a major breakthrough in airplane engineering, if I may use that term. I mean, it had never been done before. It had never even been thought of before the submarine captain wondered out loud. Is that not so?
That's true. And it would, in today's vernacular, you'd call it a mission impossible. An Army bomber, medium bomber, fully loaded, take off from an aircraft carrier, a 350-foot deck? No, it couldn't be done. The Japanese didn't think so either. And that's why the surprise.
But how do they even get 16 bombers on the flight deck of that thing and even have 380 feet left?
Well, they all had one takeoff point, which people don't realize. It wasn't as if they all, you know, as airplanes left, that they all had a greater depth. The Navy had put a non-skid material on the deck for the starting point, and they all then moved up or to that takeoff point, and they all had the same distance of deck to take off.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but they also had to be aware of the carrier's island. In terms of clipping a wing, so that
the
Navy leaves you even less room for maneuver.
Well, that's true. But the Navy had painted two lines on the deck: broad line, and then a narrower line for the nose wheel and the tail wheel, or the left main gear, and that kept them in line. That gave them a line on the deck to follow for takeoff. The B-25 was selected because it would miss the island by a few feet. The B-18 was considered, but it had too much wing spread. And the B-26 was impossible to take off. It was too fast and needed too much runway to take off. So he had decided on the B-25. If it were properly modified, could haul 2,000 pounds of bombs 2,000 miles. But the Navy had to give him some wind across the deck by the speed of the carrier.
Mm-hmm.
The carrier had to be into the wind, which is one advantage that the Navy pilots have always had, is that their landing strip and their takeoff strip can always be into the wind.
Right.
They were given protection and then helped to evade the Japanese, who launched a tremendous invasion, further invasion of China. They'd been there since 1937 along the coastal areas, mm-hmm. but pushing further inland to get the Americans and do something about it. And they, at the worst of the times, before the reaction had settled down, General Chiang Kai-shek messaged President Roosevelt. He was not told about this Doolittle raid. The reason he wasn't told ahead of time was because the people surrounding him couldn't be trusted. And so therefore he was furious, and he cabled President Roosevelt, so the story goes, that 250,000 of his countrymen had been killed as a result of him not knowing about this raid ahead of time. Well, I don't know whether that's a figure he used, and that's where that figure comes from.
Okay.
He estimated 250,000 Chinese died for any evidence that Americans had been through a village. And the fellas had change in their pocket, for example, and they would give, you know, the little kids give them a penny or a nickel or something, whatever they had, a button off their jacket or something.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great souvenir for these kids. They'd never seen white men
and
didn't know, but they knew they'd done something good for China as they passed through their villages, but they paid dearly for it.
The accounts I've read Colonel Doolittle despondent after the fact.
Yes.
He's, I believe, said to someone that it had been a failure. He had lost all the aircraft. He'd lost some crew members, and that he was certain he was going to be court-martialed and probably end up in Leavenworth. Is that correct?
That's true. His crew chief, Sergeant Paul Leonard, was with his boss, then Lieutenant Colonel Doolittle, and they found the aircraft, their aircraft. And there's a picture of General Doolittle, Colonel Doolittle, I keep calling him General, sitting despondently on the wrecked wing of his airplane. And just he and the crew chief. And Doolittle was despondent, and the crew chief recognized that. And he said, "Sir, you shouldn't have to worry because you're going to get promoted because of this." And Doolittle just shook his head. He didn't think so. He said, "I think I'll be court-martialed."
Doolittle's crew chief was right. Not only was the leader of the raid promoted to Brigadier General, he was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. Thanks to Colonel Carol Glines for sharing the Doolittle Raiders story. That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles, produced by Tim Holbert for the American Veterans Center and Kenny Burns for Radio America, in association with Pelcom Communications. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, veterans, for your service to our country.
The great sea and air battle has been raging in the Solomon area since last Sunday.
From the Radio America Network.